welcome to the teaching ministry of North Coast Church in Vista, California. We invite you to please open your Bibles as we join Pastor Chris Brown for today's message.
The garage gate is rolled away and it slowly rolls out of the drive. Sunlight gleaming off of all the steel and chrome and everything that's been polished. So it makes its way fully out, he hops in. It's the joy of every teenager. It's nice to come from a family where you have servants that polish your gear, and this one just sparkles. The chariot makes its way fully in the sunlight. I'm sure he's got the 6-inch lift on it. He's got the big tires, the chrome spinner hubs on it. 4 horsepower probably started with, but they went ahead and put 2 more up front. 6 horsepower. And I know parents, you're saying that's way too much for any teenager, but he's used to handling it. He knows he's supposed to take it slow through the city, and, you know, his family's got a reputation to think about. But once he gets out in the open countryside, that's where he just opens it up and lets them go. He makes his way down from the castle on the hill, wind blowing through his long locks, sleeves on his toga just blowing up, so his bustles and muscles and triceps and biceps all just kind of in form in the light as he just holds the reins. He sees them stare, but he doesn't pay any attention to it. The young boys who play with the marbles on the curb and throwing rocks just stop and look at him go by. They're hitting each other. That's him! That's him! Every young kid in the kingdom, if you gave him one wish, who would you like to be right now if you could change places with anyone? Oh, it's him. As he makes his way down toward the city in the marketplace and into the garment district, there the young ladies stop and just swoon. Everyone, I'm just hoping this is the day his chariot stops. He looks at them and says, would you like a ride? Every one of them with his calendar up in their bedroom, every one of them with that little dream of being there the night of prom and no dates. And there's a knock at the door and you open it up and there's Amnon, chariot glistening in the moonlight outside. And he said, hey, do you have something to wear? I'd like to take you out. A moment of changing clothes and rushing back. It's a great time with the dance. Everyone stops when you walk in to look at you and Amnon. Afterwards, up to the family's castle on the hill to take a little moonlight stroll through the garden and dessert there amongst the colonnades. And, well, you get the picture. It's Amnon. He's a guy that has everything going for him. It's not just that he lives in the castle on the hill. It's not just that he has the best of toys and the best of rides. It's not just that everybody in the kingdom wants to be like him, but it's because of a reason. You see, he's dad's first, and that comes with everything, and I mean everything. He's called King David. Those close just call him Dave. Those on the inside that grew up with him call him Sling. It's a long story, but it kind of goes back. And this is Sling's boy, next in line to be king. And in 2 Samuel chapter 13, we have the story. It starts as a love story. If you want to turn and watch it, 2 Samuel chapter 13, Old Testament. Just look for Joshua, Judges, Ruth. You probably won't see Ruth. It's small. 1 and 2 Samuel. If you hit 1 and 2 Kings, you've gone too far. So right there in the beginning, like, I don't know, 6-7 books in, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 and 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel 13, verse 1, we start this story. Now, I realize that name Amnon might not spark much memory for some of you. Whether this is your first time in church or you've been going to church for 40 years, you might be sitting there thinking, Amnon? I don't remember much about an Amnon. It's because we don't have much of him. There's basically a chapter of his life and story, and we're going to sum it up right here. And I love the way this thing starts. Are we there? 2 Samuel 13. It simply says this. In the course of time, That's Bible words for once upon a time. Ring. And you start it. Little music in the background. The camera takes you through the animated woods where the rabbits are all frolicking. Then once upon a time, a story about a prince who lives on the castle on the hill. And in the course of time, Amnon, son of David / Sling, fell in love with Tamar, the beautiful sister of Absalom, son of David. And Amnon became frustrated to the point of illness on account of his sister Tamar, for she was a virgin, and it seemed impossible for him to do anything to her. And in just 2 verses, we have what should be one of the greatest love stories of all time. In just 2 verses, it starts with a once upon a time, the prince controlling the white horses from the castle on the hill, next in line to be king of all of Israel, all of God's people. And you can't take that away. There will be no vote. There will be no two-party system. He is son of King David, therefore he will get the crown. And the guy's got everything going for him. And the Bible says he falls in love. And yet it says he falls in love with his brother Absalom's sister. And I'm thinking, if it's your brother's sister, then shouldn't that be, And then it said in the course of time, he became frustrated. Frustrated to the point of illness. Because it seemed like he couldn't do anything to her. Or it seemed like he couldn't get anything from her. And right off the bat, in just the first two sentences, we have a tragic love story gone wrong. Right off the bat, we got someone who has everything going for him, the king's son. He's going to be responsible for the entire kingdom. That every boy and girl in the entire kingdom looks at Amnon and just thinks, oh, to be like him, or oh, to be with him. And right off the bat, we find out that Amnon has lost control of his greatest sexual organ, right here between his ears, his brain. Same goes for you and I. I don't know if he's just been watching her in the palace. I don't know if he's just been finding out her agenda. Somewhere he's let his eyes fall on her. He's let his mind race. Those initial thoughts that should have just been fleeting and dismissed have just kept and been mulled on day after day after day until he is becoming physically ill, frustrated with his lust and burning because he can't get anything from her. And the once upon a time is going to turn to a dark story. Before we jump into the rest of the tragic tale, I just got to tell you, Amnon here throughout this entire thing is going to fall for one of Satan's favorite lies. It's today a lie that we call number 6, that sexual purity is for prudes and losers. I mean, doesn't that fit our society? Sexual purity is for prudes and losers. You're going to keep yourself a virgin till what? What's wrong with you? You're a loser, dude. It's because you can't get any. That's why you're a virgin. Otherwise, you wouldn't make that stand. I mean, we make comedies about that. A 30 or 40-year-old virgin, that's laughable. That's something to pay $9 and laugh at. Come on, are you serious? You're going to be a virgin in our society today till when? And what if marriage doesn't happen? Then what? Way to think that one out, smart guy. Or you're just some prude. Someone that's stuck in a way of doing things that's 1,000 years old. I mean, do you realize the Bible's view on sexuality is so outdated, so antiquated? Are you really going to follow that? Nowadays, we've got all the scientific evidence that we need for our own biology, for our own understanding, for our own protection, and it's okay to be sexually active. Just be safe, and by the means, with consenting adults, or at least a consenting partner. And if you can do it in that realm, then hey, have fun. It comes out in 3 different ways, Satan's favorite lie. The ancient lie can be said this way, if you want to take your note sheet, that sex is just a physical act. Because isn't that all we're talking about? Sex is just a physical act. It's a natural response of the male and female body. And you're telling me there's something wrong with that? There's something dirty about that? Come on. It's purely physical. And as long as you're safe with it, I mean, you can die nowadays, you know, having sex with the wrong people, the wrong places. But as long as you're safe, it's just a physical act, like anything else your body does. So why is that so wrong? And since that's the lie, then secondly, if you're not sexually active, you're just missing out. Because it's simply physical pleasure. Why are you putting any restrictions on it? Because the most you put restrictions on it, then you're missing out. You're missing out on what you're wired to do. You're missing out on the full expression of your humanity. You're missing out on the full expression of your sexuality. I mean, come on. It's just a physical act. Thirdly, it kind of comes out in this way. Therefore, a great lover is someone with many partners. Man, we see that in all of our heroes. I didn't see the movie, but one of our guys on staff told us this week in the latest James Bond that I guess he has a sexual affair with a married woman, and he's got a line that says, in fact, I like having sexual affairs with married women. It's less complicated. There's nothing expected. You go back to your way, I go back to my way. It's just a physical act. Think of how many of our heroes or heroines today are people that have many partners. Guys that walk into the room and after 15 minutes at the casino table walk out with the hottest woman in the house. That's a great lover. And we live in a society today that is so sexually charged and stimulated from all facets of all of our senses, from all imagination. And what do you do with that? People, we're going to get to some of these, but before we answer these in a little bit, I got to jump on that last one. I believe a great lover is not someone that has 20 or 30 partners. I think a great lover is someone who satisfies a single person for 30 or 40 years. Now that makes a great lover. Ooh, don't get me carried away. So some of the lies we looked at. In there we have chapter 13 of 2 Samuel. In here we're going to see what should be one of the most phenomenal love stories gone bad right at the beginning. In here we're going to see, we're going to watch. Verse 3. Now Amnon had a friend named Jonadab, son of Shimeah, David's brother. And Jonadab was a very shrewd man. And he asked Amnon, "Why do you, you're the king's son, you look so haggard, morning after morning, why won't you tell me?" And Amnon said to him, "I'm in love. I'm in love with Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." So Amnon has a cousin named Jonadab. It's Sling's brother's son. And his cousin comes up, and they're in the locker room after lacrosse one day, and the chariots are parked outside, and they're ready to race. But he's looking at him and says, "Dude, you've been down lately. What has gotten into you, dude? You're moping around. I'm sick of watching you. You're the king's son, i.e., you have everything going for you. If there is anybody in the kingdom that should be the happiest guy alive, it's you. Everybody wants to be you. Everyone wants to be with you. You've got the entire kingdom. The castle on the hill is yours. You've got the crown. The entire kingdom will be yours one day. Why are you so bummed?" And as the locker room empties, he just lets them know, "Dude, I'm in love." "Well, dude, that's a great thing." "It's my brother Absalom's sister." Dude, this lust has so consumed him, he can't even see reality anymore. He can't even call her his own sister. "It's my brother's sister." "Well, isn't that your..." "Yeah, that's the problem." "What's the big deal?" "Dude, I gotta have her. And I don't think there's any way to get anything from her. And it is driving me crazy. The little passing thought, the little glimpse, that little vision that you catch has now become not just more than a thought, but a fantasy life that's run rampant. It is so hard to turn this thing off. It is so hard to get what I've been putting into my brain and what I've been feeding it in sexual stimulation. Then I'll say, 'Hey, I'm done with that. That's not right. I'm moving on.' Because every time I close my eyes, or every time I go to sleep, or every time he rides back to the castle, he prays to God. This is a night he's so tired he falls asleep. Otherwise, he's left there in the prince's chambers by himself and his thoughts, and he knows where they're going to go. And it's day after day after day until it has just consumed him. Because once again, guys, ladies, if we cannot control our greatest sexual organ, it will control us. And he can't shut this thing off. And he finally voices it. But he voices it to a cousin. A cousin who's just as ignorant as he is. And unfortunately, whatever your sexual bent, unfortunately, whatever your desires, unfortunately, however you want to do your sexual life, I guarantee you, you will find someone in this world today that will tell you it's okay, just go for it. And you will take that as, "Oh, that's great affirmation." Even when it comes from a lousy cousin. Because verse 5, he says, "Go to bed and pretend to be ill," Jonadab says. "When your father comes to see you, just say to him, 'I would like my sister Tamar to come and give me something to eat. Let her prepare the food in my sight so that I may watch her and then eat it from her hand.' So Amnon laid down. He pretended to be ill. And when King David came to see him, Amnon said to him, 'I would like my sister Tamar to come make some special bread in my sight, so that I may eat it from her hand.' So David sent word to Tamar up at the palace, 'Go to the house of your brother Amnon and prepare some food for him.' So Tamar went to the house of her brother Amnon, who was lying down. She took some dough, she kneaded it, and she made the bread in his sight and baked it. And then he took the pan, and then she took the pan and served him the bread, but he refused to eat. 'Send everyone out of here,' Amnon said. So everyone left him," or left the house. Four times in these few verses, four times, even though it's a 3,000-year-old story written somewhere around 1,000 B.C., four times, Scripture, writer, the Holy Spirit, writing through men, wants to know, "God, I want you to get this visual thing here." Four times, "I want her in my sight. I want to be able to watch her. She came and did it in his sight, and he watched her make the bread." You see this playing out. He goes back to the prince's side of the palace or his little chateau and lays down. Word comes back. "Hey, Dave, your kid hasn't been showing up for his duties. People say he's not coming out. I think something's wrong." Well, that's got to strike fear in the heart, especially 1,000 years B.C. to the medicine and the illnesses back then. You can't lose the next in line. And King rushes to the house. "Am, what's happening, buddy?" "Dad, I'm just weak. Dad, I don't know. Maybe it's something I ate. Maybe I'm just tired. Maybe I just need a rest. I just feel like I'm so weak. Is there anything I can do for you?" "I don't. Well, you know what? Tamar makes those little muffins. Man, that sounds good right now. Maybe I just need to eat and rest. Well, I'll have her make a batch. You know what? Can she do it here at my place? I love the smell of that. I don't know why Dad doesn't get the hint right now. Dad's going to fail to show up all through this story, especially at the end. I tend to think because we're two chapters away from 2 Samuel 11. Just two chapters ago, Dad was up on the rooftop watching porn. And once again, he fed this organ. And once again, it consumed him. And once again, just watching wasn't enough, but he invited her in. And once again, it wasn't just the nakedness of her, but he needed the touch. And once he sleeps and has an affair with his neighbor who was bathing on the roof, she turns up pregnant. He kills her husband to cover it up. And I think that's probably the reason Dad can't speak into his son's sexuality. Because he's lost his own. And he's a hypocrite and he knows he has no ground to stand on. People, don't get me wrong. We're going to follow the pattern of the first family. It's going to show up again, 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 and again. So Tamar is sent. She makes that bread that she makes. She brings it in. Amnon kicks everybody out of the house. And then Amnon said to Tamar in verse 10, "Bring the food here into my bedroom so that I may eat it from your hand." And Tamar took the bread she had prepared. She brought it to her brother Amnon in his bedroom. But when she took it to him to eat, he grabbed her and he said, "Come to bed with me, my sister." "Don't, my brother," she said to him. "Don't force me. Such a thing should never be done in Israel. Don't do this wicked thing. What about me? Where can I get rid of my disgrace? And what about you? You will be like one of the wicked fools in Israel. Please, just speak to the king. He will not keep me from being married to you." You have this passionate plea. She's not just beautiful. She's smart. She's intelligent. She understands the word of God. "We as Israelites don't act this way. Don't, my brother." She pleads on Israel, on people of God, and on the family union. "And what about me? If you really care about me, that's not what you're about. Because think of the disgrace and think of what it's going to cause me. And what about you? You're going to be like one of those idiot fools. You imagine when word gets out that the prince has slept with his sister, what the people are going to say? You're going to be on every tabloid, every news, every magazine rack. You're going to be an idiot. And just ask the king. And if you ask the king, maybe he'll let us be married." Now, Leviticus 18 makes it very clear. Brothers, don't marry sisters. But you can see she's grasping for any way out. What does the prince, next in line to rule God's people from the castle on the hill, do? Verse 14. But he refuses to listen to her. And since he was stronger than she, he raped her. Then Amnon hated her with intense hatred. In fact, he hated her more than he had ever loved her. And Amnon said to her, "Get up and get out." "No," she said to him. "Sending me away would be now even a greater wrong than what you have already done to me." But he refused to listen to her. And he called back in his personal servants and said, "Get this woman out of here and bolt the door after her." So his servants put her out and bolted the door after her. She was wearing a richly ornamented robe, for this was the kind of garment that the virgin daughters of the king wore. And Tamar put ashes on her head. She tore the ornamented robe that she was wearing. She put her hand on her head, and she went away weeping aloud as she went. And her brother Absalom said to her, Has that Amnon, your brother, been with you? Be quiet now, my sister, because he is your brother. Don't take this thing to heart." And Tamar lived in her brother Absalom's house, a desolate woman. And when King David heard all this, he was furious. And that's the end of his reaction. Dad got mad, but never stepped in. 2 years later, because Dad never stepped in, Absalom will come up to Amnon in the field and run a sword through him and kill him there on the spot. 2 years of Dad doing nothing. So Absalom, brother number two, he'll solve it. Brother number two, Absalom, will have such a growing discontent about Dad and a lack of respect for Dad that he will take over Dad's kingdom, run David out of his own throne, and take over prematurely. He'll take the advice once again of a bad friend in chapter 16 and take all of David's wives. Yes, he had many, even though the Bible said you should only have one. But David's the king, and he needs to satisfy his own desires. So he will take all of Dad's wives and concubines up on the rooftop, and he will rape them in front of the entire city, so everyone knows there's a new man in town. When David's forces come out and find him and come back and take the castle back, Amnon will flee. His long hair will get caught in the trees as he's riding under it. And they'll come and they'll thrust javelins into his heart. And son number two is dead. Son number three, Adonijah, in 1 Kings chapter 1, will decide that he needs to take over Dad's throne. He'll put in this little evil plot to marry one of his father's wives. Therefore, he'll have a better claim than Solomon, the other son vying for the throne. Solomon will find out and kill Adonijah. And son number three dies. Oh, by the way, the little affair that no one seemed to know about on the rooftop, She becomes pregnant and the baby dies just after a matter of days. What has happened to the first family of God? What has happened to a guy that came up being called Sling because of an amazing battle against a Goliath? A man that was called a man after God's own heart. What has happened in God's people with God's leadership? People, that is the most dysfunctional family I've ever heard about, Bible or not Bible. And it all comes down to one area of sexuality that wasn't controlled, wasn't talked about, and let run chaos. And it destroys all of them from the beginning. We should have 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. Then we should have 1 and 2 Amnon in our Bible. Not one chapter. We should have books written about the next in line, a man who grows up in a home that fears God, a kid that grows up under a guy like David, a strong leader in the kingdom and God's community, a kid that grows up and takes Israel from the place it is to sites that have never been thought of before. We should have two books written about this incredible, courageous leader, this guy Amnon. But he can't control this. So instead, God says, give him a chapter. And even though this is going to be a dark spot in the history of Israel, write what happened. Because 3,000 years later, we're going to be struggling with the same stuff. It's a tragic story. People, I got to call a timeout and say Tamar in this story did absolutely nothing wrong. There's absolutely no hint. There is no gesture. There's nothing written here that Tamar in any way acted in any sinful way or disobedience. She is simply, because of a fallen world we live in, one of many, unfortunately, one of many consequences of somebody else's sin. The Bible will give her absolutely no blame throughout this whole thing. Because I know this story, unfortunately, with all the venues watching today, I know this story hits close to home for a lot of you. And unfortunately, it's the end of what we hear of Tamar, the king's daughter. She lives in her brother's house, a desolate woman. I'm sure Absalom, her brother, is trying to protect her. I'm sure he's trying to protect the family. Hey, did Amnon do this? Look, he is your brother, so let's keep this in the family. Let's not say anything. And just try to forget about it. Let's move on. Well, that could be very easily done if it was just a physical act. But people, sex is not a physical act. And you can't move on. And she will never forget. And yes, these things need to come out. And yes, in God's kingdom, there is grace, not just for the wrong we've done, but even for the innocent who have been wronged, that God can give and restore and make a great story out of even stories like this. But I got to drop a side note that there's absolutely no wrong in Tamar on this. It's simply a tragic story. What do you do with this? I'll tell you the truth about sexuality, the truth about sexual purity. To do that, let's go back to what sex is. I don't think I've ever heard everyone in church ever tell me that. Let's go back and talk about sex. I grew up in a Christian home, and in this, I won't even say the denomination, but these very conservative Christian churches, where you don't talk about sex, unless someone tells you it is dirty and it is wrong and it should never be thought about or done. And that was kind of my view on sex. People, I'm so frustrated that we have given sex to Satan. I'm so frustrated that sexuality, and all of us are created to be sexual beings, we think that is something dirty or something wrong, and it's something God created. We act as if God created naked man and naked woman and said, okay, now let's go out and start things, and then Satan comes up and goes, look what your bodies can do, and God's like, oh, I didn't know that. Knock it off. Oh, why did I put so many nerve endings in those? Oh, man, I think I've just lost them. Are you kidding me? God creates things and separates waters from earth and darkness from lights and stars and animals and all that we see in the beginning creation, the first two chapters of Genesis. After all the creation, God says, this is good, this is good, this is good. God creates sexuality, naked man, naked woman, and he goes, mahold. First adjective we have in the Bible comes from God. It means this is exceedingly, abundantly beyond expectations. What did he say that about? Naked man and naked woman who felt no shame. God realized he had created the pinnacle of creation, sexuality, and he stepped back and said, Mehor. It blows away the animal kingdom. It blows away the waterfalls and the islands and the paradises, whatever you want. Mehor. This is exceedingly abundantly. God pats himself on the chest and says, I've outdone myself on this one. There's no surprise to God on that. You realize some of the most erotic poetry we have, ancient poetry, comes from Song of Solomon? The most erotic literature we have, ancient literature, comes from the Bible. Isn't that cool? That belongs to us. And you're like, well, it's just like, you know, you got to have children. So you got, oh, knock it off. Read chapters 4, 5, read chapters 4 through 8. Only if you're married and over 21. And it's these incredible passages of a guy that goes away in the vineyards and Solomon walks. He's away on a business trip, but his mind, even though he's looking at the fields, he's looking at the crops, his mind starts racing about his bride and the fantasy life about coming back to her while she sleeps, about walking in unnoticed and showing up early from a business trip. And, well, you got to read the rest yourself. But the Bible says this is Mahod. I did that. Genesis 2:24 says this. I don't know if I asked you to turn there. I didn't myself, so hold on a second. It's the first book, so it should be quick. Genesis 2:24. For this reason, man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. The man and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. God says, for this reason, sexuality. He creates Adam. Adam has God all to himself. He says, name the animals, the beast, everything. Adam goes to work. Adam's doing an amazing job with God and God alone in paradise. No sin. And God goes, this isn't good. It's not good just to have you and me together. I got to create an opposite. I got to create a companion. I got to create a completeness. And he creates naked man, naked woman. He says, for this reason. And you know what reason I'm talking about. You're going to leave your family. I don't care how great your family is. And the two of you will cling together and you will become one flesh. That word there translated in the Septuagint is bios. You will become one life force. He says from the very beginning, sex will not be physical. Sex will always be social. It'll always be emotional. It'll always be spiritual. He says, I create intimacy to be a permanent bond. Jesus will take that in Mark chapter 10 and said, therefore, what God has joined together, let no man ever separate. Don't touch this. It's a permanent bond. If you're following some truth about sex and sexual purity, that God created sex to be simply a permanent bond, never to be pulled away, never to be outdone. He said, in this union, you will leave families, cling to each other, and become one family. He goes, here's your wedding gift. Man, it's a doozy. It's going to beat any toaster or crock pot you ever unwrap. He says, but in this, it's going to be a permanent bond. I'm going to give you an intimacy. People, I'm tired also of sexuality in the Bible saying, well, that's intercourse. Anything but it is okay. Please find me that verse. Because the Bible talks about sexuality or sexual morality as any physical act that's supposed to be restrained for husband and wife. That is sexuality, to be reserved for marriage. People, what's reserved for me and my wife comes long before just intercourse. Okay? Let me promise you that. I drive home from work today and she's walking on the street holding hands with the mailman. I'm swerving for the mailman. Okay? That's just it. I'm like, that's my hand. I'm not okay with, oh, yeah, she holds hands with a lot of guys. She's just fun. She just like walks at the beach. Doesn't matter who it's with. We're kind of progressive. We're open that way. No. Just talking about it. And the Bible says, look, I want to talk not about intercourse. I want to talk about intimacy. I want to talk about sexual intimacy. The Bible will talk about anywhere that there is lust, anywhere that starts the desire, anywhere that fire starts. He said, that's what's reserved for marriage. And it's going to be a permanent bond. And it's going to be something that unites you, your bios, one life together, like nothing else. Secondly, then, sex is far more than just a physical act. It's far more than just a physical act. That's why so many of us today are sitting here with the scars that we have. So many of us are sitting here today with the wounds that we have. So many of us are sitting here today with the memories from the past and the aches and the loss. Why? If it was just a physical act, why? Because it was a giving of self. It was a union that was never supposed to be used and used and used and used. But it was a union that's supposed to be used once in marriage and never to be taken apart. That's why some of us feel cheated. That's why some of us feel used. That's why some of us are abused. That's why some of us have that guilt, even though we're trying to walk with God. That's why Satan still uses the past. Remember that weekend? Remember that Friday? Remember that time? Remember that business trip? Because it was far more than just a physical act. Which brings us to this then. Sex is powerful enough to consume everything. Sex is powerful enough to consume everything. I originally wrote, sex is powerful enough to consume us and our relationship, but I realize it goes beyond that. I realized this week I got a phone call from a family. It was some kids that grew up in my junior high, then high school, then kind of knew them through college, was a part of their weddings. And I got a phone call from one part of the family, and they found out some incredible news of what Dad's been hiding for years and years. And they're broken, and they're angry, and they don't know what to do with it. I didn't realize this, but back at home at the same time, the other side of the family had called looking for me and talked to my wife. And they had a long talk about what they had found out. We had no idea that the next day I would get a call from the parents. He was a leader in a Christian organization I was working for. He's a guy I respected greatly. And he said, "Hey, we just finished a counseling appointment. Some stuff come up. I feel like I got to talk to you. Can we drive down?" And I said, "You know, we got an activity with growth group, but you can come by." And we started a conversation from about 10 o'clock at night till about 1:30 in the morning. And he sits there in tears dripping down on my kitchen table. I know his family. I know his kids. I know their families are wrecked, and I have to hear it from him. Here's how it started. And it was just small little things, and it just started to consume me. And here's where it's led. His wife sits across the table, and she shakes with anger and hurt and sorrow as she has to hear it again. And it consumes. I don't know how many of us, kids from the King, who have amazing roles in the kingdom, are going to have simply a short chapter saying, "Here's the potential, here's everything God wanted, but here's what we did with sexuality." And no books will be written. Because it's Satan's lie. Hey, please yourself. Make sure you don't hurt anyone else. Be safe. No one's going to find out. It's a victimless crime. And another story goes unwritten. I've said it before. God created sex to be like nuclear power. Used in the right way, and the big reactors out on the coast, man, it can light up a city. Dropped in a bomb, it will level a city. And God says, "There's sex. Happy wedding day. Use it the way I've created it for. This will be one of the most intimate, powerful, permanent bonds you will ever share with anyone. And by the way, it's going to be a heck of a lot of fun and enjoyment. Use it the wrong way, well, you're going to walk around singed and scarred. And you will definitely have the ability to blow up other people's lives like tomorrow." And God says, "Here's sex. I created it. I know what I'm talking about. It doesn't surprise me how you function and how you wire and how you work. I gave that to you." But it's not just physical. It has huge ramifications. Satan knows that. There's a book, Every Man's Battle, had a great quote. It says, "Before we're married, Satan does everything he can to get us to have sex with other people in our lives. After we're married, Satan does everything he can to keep us from having sex with our spouse." I read that and it just hit me. Wow, that's a good one. Before you're married and you're singleness, Satan says, "Look, have sex, explore, do whatever. It's just physical, it's yours." But once you get married, he tries so hard to interrupt that intimacy between husband and wife. He tries so hard to get your thoughts on other people or other things. He tries so hard to make sure that marriage bed is, well, it's a pretty cold bed. Why? Because he knows the power of that. He knows what it can do in the union of husband and wife and Christian people. He knows what it does for the sake of marriage and home. And he got David on the rooftop, and that was pretty much it. Because now I know I can pick off the boys one by one, and Dad, keep your mouth shut. Who are you to say anything? Remember the rooftop? Remember the affair that got pregnant? Remember killing her husband to cover it up? Now you're going to sit down on the edge of the bed in your teenage son's life and tell him what, big guy? Thanks, but no thanks. It's a short chapter. It's a short chapter. I was thinking of that, how to describe it, and I realized someone gave Amy and I a little getaway. It was one of those little artsy communities up on the coast, and they gave us this little cottage-type thing. It was about 8-9 years ago, and we go there, and it was a small little room. We go out in the town and look around a bunch of oil paintings and come walking back. We sit there, and I'm like, "Okay, I'm going to turn on ESPN." You grab this little remote control. It just had an on-off button on it, so I was trying to figure it out. I clicked the TV, and the fireplace came on. And I was like, "Oh, click, boom, click, oh." Open the windows. We're right on one of these little rock beaches that's terrible to walk on in the daytime, so I was bummed. But at night, the sound of all those stones being thrown up and rolling back down. The windows open, the breeze is blowing. There's fire in the fireplace, and that's all I can tell you about that night. There is something about that fire in the fireplace. There's something about fire. There's something about walking home and around the edge of the tub and everything in the bathroom. There's candles all over, and you're like, "Okay, no Sports Center. I'm good." There's something about that in romance. There's something about that. And just this week, our growth group got invited out. One of our people had a campsite, and we all show up with our kids, and we have a great day, great feast. We do the bonfire, and everyone sits around with marshmallows, and it's just, man, there's something cool about that fire. I realized growing up as a boy, I love fire. whether it was melting army man or doing whatever, fire. And I thought, man, it's just great to have around, isn't it? And I started thinking about that. I think, let's all share in that. Why can't we all experience just a great fire? Now, I know for Boy Scouts, you probably know a lot of different ways of lighting fire, but the Texas way is pretty simple. You just get some good old gasoline. I don't want to get any of this on me because it kind of stinks. But you just kind of, yeah. Oh, no, you can never have too much. Never have too much. Yeah. And once you get that gasoline, just let it soak in. You got a good fire. Isn't it great to have a great fire going? It's just, there's something about it. There's something I'd love to share with you guys, because there's something about having a fire. To take this and to just let that go. Oh, maybe I have too much water in my gasoline. Because you'd sit there and go, Chris, you've done some dumb things, but this would be stupid. To show gasoline and start a bonfire on stage? You guys are like, you burn our place. Now the Edge is like, go for it, live! Burn! How stupid, why? We talked about how great a fire is. We talked about how romantic a fire is. We talked about how great it is to have a fire. Why? Because all of us are smart enough to realize fires are great in the fireplace. You take it outside and you burn the home. And God says, can you understand? I created sex. I created your sexuality. I want you to have incredible sex life. I never knew that about God. He goes, but remember, I need that in a place because outside of it, it will consume you. Outside of that, it'll burn not just you, but others. Outside of that way, it'll eat you away. Oh, you can keep it covered up, and you may never be found out. But I guarantee you, it'll consume you to a point where you're taken out of any usefulness in the kingdom. I guarantee you, it can take you to the point where you have no usefulness in the family's life. And we've all seen it, haven't we? And God says, man, put it in the place I designed it for. It's going to be amazing. Take it outside. Trust me, he says. I created you and it. I know what I'm talking about. And throughout history, we've seen it consume. We've tried to use it differently now. We've tried to be smarter now. Our society will tell us, man, you save yourself for marriage and get married, you're talking about boring. How boring is it to be intimate with just one person your entire life? You know what you're missing out on? And yet all the data today tells us differently. From the case for marriage, married couples have more sex and more satisfying sex than singles or divorced people. Yeah, no brainer. Contrary to what Sex and the City wants to tell us on TV. Married men, even at the age of 50, have all reported a double in satisfaction rate than single men in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. British condom maker surveyed 44% of people in Great Britain and the United States. 44%, only 44% of the thousands they surveyed were satisfied with the sex life. But out of those that said they were satisfied, 82% of those were people who were in a marriage relationship. And this is from one of the greatest condom maker we have, the biggest, saying, hey, let's just survey all our people. And they say, yeah, you know what? Only 44% are saying, yeah, I'm satisfied. But they surveyed those that were satisfied and 82% were married couples. And they're like, what? But they're stuck with a person. Yeah. Yeah. The University of Michigan, 79% of married couples were strongly satisfied with intimacy and sexuality in their life versus 31% of the single students and people that they were able to survey. So we've gotten in this thing where let's just be committed, but let's just get rid of marriage. Let's live together. And in the last 30 years, those that are cohabiting or living together is up 700%. That's the new thing to do. I mean, it makes sense. Before you buy a car, you got to test drive it. So move in, make sure it works. It's a big deal. You know, my parents never made it, so let's live together and make sure it works. And it's a way you can safeguard for a healthier marriage. Well, that falls into line number 6. An amazingly large number of Americans see cohabitating as something of a laboratory for future marriage. Individuals agree to cohabitate, enjoying personal and sexual intimacy without making the final commitment of marriage. But the couples that live together now are 80% more likely to have a marriage end in divorce than those who just get married through a relationship. You're 80% more likely. We already got a huge divorce rate. Can we agree in our country? But if you live together before you get married, you are 80% more likely to have that marriage end in divorce. This is all secular studies. Only 1 in 5 living together couples actually get married. You slide into marriage without ever making an explicit decision to commit. We move in together, we get comfortable, and pretty soon marriage starts to seem like a path of least resistance. Regardless of the health of our relationship, we share things in common, we share apartment, we share home, we share money, we share finances, we share kids, and inevitably, it's just what you need to do, regardless of the strength of the relationship. Because there's such a lack to commit to marriage ahead of time and simply to live together, then it is very easy to get out of marriage because you have that lack of commitment to start with. Research found that people who cohabit say they're less satisfied and more likely to feel depressed, the result of inherent lack of stability in living together. As a result, living together is not an ideal living arrangement for children. Emotionally or academically, the children of those living together just don't do as well on average as those with two married parents. And money doesn't fully explain the difference. The number of cases of major depression per 100 people in the United States. Married and never divorced people, 1.5 out of 100 severe depression. Never married, 2.4%. Divorced once, 4.1%. Living together, 6.5%. Divorced twice, 5.8%. You want to get on a path that leads you to a greater risk of depression than any other single, living, divorce, separated, whatever in there. Live together. That's what the statistics show. And yet we fall into this thing of intimacy can be used outside of the confines of marriage or outside of the fireplace. People, I love the way the Bible treats sexuality. I love the fact that God says, I want you to have a great sex life. I created it for you. But I love the way God says, look, you want to end up in your notes. We've kind of hit them, but just write these three down. When God says no, it is to protect and to provide for us. When you come across a clear no in the Bible, realize God's just protecting or providing. He goes, I want to protect you from getting burned or consumed. I want to provide for you a great intimate future. To do that, do it my way. I created it, he says. I know what I'm talking about. Which leads to this, flee, don't flirt with temptation. You can underline that 1 Corinthians 6 passage above there. Where God says, any other sin a man commits is outside the body, but he who sits sexually sins with the body. Don't you know that you're bought with a price? Don't you know that you're the temple of God? I want you to flee from all sexual immorality. I don't want to lose you to it, because God knows, he goes, I will lose you to this. That's how powerful it is. And it comes down to finally this, can I trust God enough to give him my sexuality? Can I trust God enough to give him my sexuality? Don't put all your papers and Bibles away. Just listen. Mark chapter 10, there's a story of a rich young ruler who comes and says, Lord, I want to follow you. And Jesus says, go sell everything you have, give it to the poor and come back. And the guy goes, I can't do that. And then Jesus says, then you don't need a Lord. And the man walks away sad. I think in our day and age, for so many of us, whether we're single, whether we've been married and been divorced, and we had that intimacy and now we're trying to crave that again, whether we're widowed, whether we're married and keeping it within a marriage or outside the marriage, I think for so many of us, it is just a struggle. And we come and say, God, I want to follow you. And God says, then I want your sexuality my way. Oh, I can't do that. You don't understand the financials. You don't understand who he means to me. You don't understand. And God says, then you don't need a Lord. You're not ready for a Lord. Do I trust God enough to give him my sexuality? And that's where we're left. Man, you could go on for hours on that, but we got to wind it down. And now it's just a decision for you. There's some great verses to read. People, I don't want to drive by guilting. Wherever you fall in that, there's a God that says, today there's forgiveness and grace, and I will draw new chapters. In your homework, there's a lot of verses, and there's questions to deal with forgiveness and grace, where God says, Chris, in spite of who you are and what you've done, I can still use you and make a great chapter or a great book or a great saga. But the choice is yours. So, Father, thanks for sex. I don't think I've ever heard that prayer in church. Well, I really do enjoy it and say thanks, God, for creating us the way you have, and yet it is so tempting to use that outside of marriage. May today be a day we just get a glimpse of your desire for us, and for those of us that are struggling or going outside for that, for those of us that are single, God may protect us, and God may it simply be a choice of do we trust you enough with our sexuality, and may you find us obedient in that matter, in your name. Amen.
We hope you've enjoyed today's study from God's Word. Pastor Chris will return in a moment with some final comments. For more information, or if you'd like additional copies, please contact us at area code 760-724-6700. Our mailing address is North Coast Church, 1132 North Melrose Drive, Vista, California, 92083. or visit our website at www.northcoastchurch.com. Now here's Pastor Chris.
You know, as you go, the subject matter is different, but the lie is the same. It started on page 3. And Satan comes and said, did God really say that about sexuality? But look, it looks good. It tastes good. It feels good. And see, it's not going to kill you. It's great. Do it your way. Be your own God in this area. Just be safe. Be smart. It's just a physical act. No one will find out. There's no harm done. Because he knows you're a man or a woman of the king. And the castle on the hill, who's got a huge role to play in the kingdom. And he knows this can consume you. And just make it a short chapter in your life. Don't fall for that lie. Trust God enough to say, I don't get it. I'd love to do it differently. But my sexuality is your way because you're God. And watch what he does in your life. So turn around, greet another bonfire on your way out. And we'll see you guys next week.